Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien.
Welcome back to another episode of The Lobbying Show. Today we come to you in the middle of our pandemic and everyone working from home. We are working from home. And today we're sitting down with Sheila Nix, who is the president of Tusk Philanthropies. And we're going to talk about her career, and we're going to talk about her work at Tusk, where they focus on hunger and mobile voting. And we're going to have a particular focus on mobile voting, given everything that is going on. And they've had some incredible pilots with military personnel abroad. And they have had some incredible success in Seattle, which we will get to later on. But Sheila, I'm not even sure. Are you in New York or Chicago?
Where no, I'm in Chicago.
You're in Chicago. Okay. Yeah. Well, and Sheila is also working from home. So we are practicing the stay home and stay safe as everyone is trying to do. So Sheila, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And you went to the University of Chicago Law School. So you are, did you grow up in Chicago?
I did. I grew up in Chicago and then I lived in DC for about 13 years. And then okay. Came back to Chicago after working for Jill Biden in left the White House in beginning in 2017 and then came back here. And I work as Tusk Philanthropies is located in New York, but we have about 8 or 9 people in the Tusk Ventures team that work out of Chicago.
So so tell us about what did you do after the University of Chicago?
Yeah, so I went to DC and I worked at a law firm, Arnold & Porter, for a couple of years and then left there.
That small little law firm, Arnold & Porter.
Yeah. And then I left there and was the in-house counsel on Bob Kerry's presidential campaign way back in 1992. So I worked on his campaign and then after that went to his Senate office, and I worked in a Senate office for about 7 years. So I started off doing healthcare policy and then became the legislative director and then his chief of staff.
Wow. So can we, so what was that like? I mean, Bob Kerry for, you know, our listeners that may remember, was a bit of a rock star, at the time. He was kind of the, just had a real star quality to him and a following, and obviously even when he was in the Senate, as you mentioned, he was always talked about even when he wasn't running for president, being a presidential candidate. What was it like working for him and in his Senate office?
It was great. So he's very interesting and kind of always on the cutting edge of ideas and things. So it was a great office to work in. And also just, I think maybe a lot of the people that worked in his office, the younger staff came from Nebraska and they had a very close relationship with each other. So still some of my best friends that, you know, I talk to every day come from working in Bob Kerry's office. And I just recently saw him 2 months ago in Nebraska. I'm on the board now of Creighton University where I went for undergrad. And we had Bob come out and speak to the students. And so I got to catch up with him and get dinner. And he's still great, still has lots of good ideas and is living in New York now. So that was a great experience.
And was he the head, wasn't he the president of a school in New York?
Yeah, was the president of his school for maybe 10 years or so after he left the Senate.
Okay. And what was it like working on the Hill? Was that one of your favorite jobs? I mean, obviously,
yeah,
it was enormous
definitely,
responsibility.
Yeah, definitely one of my favorite jobs. It's just such a great environment. You're doing something new every day. I mean, I don't know if it's exactly the same now, but at the time, right, we were still able to get a lot done. And then the great thing was after I worked for Bob, then when he retired, I became chief of staff for Bill Nelson from Florida. And Bill, and what was fun about that is, when I was Bob's chief of staff, I was like his fourth chief of staff because, you know, it'd been a while. And so you kind of inherited certain structures and ways of doing things that were fine, you know, but it was fun when I was Bill's first chief of staff in the Senate, because I got to set it up the way I wanted to and, you know, bring in the teams that I wanted, and he was on interesting committees. And so that was, it was like two different experiences, but both equally great. And again, just like being on the Hill with other colleagues and other offices and stuff, it's a great work experience, a great way to meet people for, you know, that you'll stay in touch with for a long time.
And then what'd you do after you left Senator Nelson's office?
So then I came back to Chicago and I worked in the governor's office in Illinois. That was an interesting experience because I worked for Governor Blagojevich, who's been in the news lately. Yes. But that's actually where I met Bradley Tusk, who I'm working with again now. So that worked out. I was I worked on Rod's reelection campaign in 2006, and then I was deputy governor. From then until luckily for me, I left in summer of 2008. So before all the legal trouble started. So that was, you know, a very crazy and interesting experience that didn't turn out exactly how I expected.
Now, did you have a number of former, I would imagine a lot of people had to hire lawyers and spend a lot of money, on lawyers and never got caught up in it, but still had to spend a lot of money.
I definitely hired a lawyer because I knew I'd have to answer some questions. But luckily for me, and I've said this before, I wasn't there at the beginning of the administration. I wasn't there at the end, and that's where it seemed like most of the problems had occurred. So yeah, while I had to like answer some questions, I was lucky. Unfortunate that I wasn't involved in any of the problem areas. And it's still, you know, when you're working somewhere and then that person's involved in a big controversy and legal issues, it's not the best thing for your resume. So, you know, you go in thinking like, this is going to be a great job and a great opportunity. And it turns out to be not so much of that, but you know, those things happen.
But the silver lining was you met Bradley Tusk.
Yeah. So it's interesting because after, I left the governor's office in the summer of 2008, and I joined the strategy group who was doing direct mail for the Obama campaign. And so it was fortunate for me. They just needed somebody. They wanted a senior person to come in and oversee like the Midwestern states for Obama on the mail piece. And so I did that until the election. And I was actually kind of thinking I would just stay on there. But then shortly after the election, in the beginning of that following year, I got a call from the One Campaign, which is the organization that Bono started that focuses on sub-Saharan Africa. And they were looking for a U.S. executive director and were interested in kind of the combination of experience I had, which was politics and campaigns, but also government and then the grassroots piece. So they kind of wanted someone for everything. And one of my interview questions, you know, they asked me about my experience on foreign policy and some of the deep development policy stuff, which I really didn't have that. But, you know, my answer was like, you have like 10 people on your staff that know how to do that part. And I can learn that part. But I think the understanding of how actual campaigns impact governments and constituents and how you can pull all that together was what I brought to the table. And that was a great job too, because I was able to travel quite a bit to sub-Saharan Africa and really learn a lot about global health, global economic policies that can help people in developing countries. And, you know, just really, really, really amazing. So I'm very fortunate to have had that experience.
And what did you, what assumptions did you have going in that turned out to be false? When you traveled to Africa?
Well, I think one of the things that I really learned throughout the experience is that any kind of solutions in any community have to come from within the community. And it's like, you can have your ideas on what it might, you know, what might be the right solution, but that's not always right. And you have to take your lead from the people who live there and work and live in the community all the time. And then, you know, try to match that up with some existing programs. But you have to, I think there's sometimes, I think going into that thing, you're like, oh, well, we have all the answers. I guess that would be the thing that I learned is like, we don't have all the answers. And a lot of the answers that work the best over time are really the homegrown ones.
Well, you guys had some great success.
Yeah. A lot of work around HIV drugs and then moved into Feed the Future was like a lot of agriculture programs and that especially too, where you could. One of the things that was really interesting that we found is if you invested in women farmers, that money would go a long way because they were, the women were very hardworking, but also used a lot of the money for education and healthcare for their kids. And so it was kind of that same thing where if you work with a community, you invest in the community, in the people who are, you know, who will make the best decisions in the community, you can get really good results. So that was, you know, just really, really interesting. And I was able to, you know, what we tried to do is bring people from the U.S. That were politically influential, whether they were a member of Congress or a political consultant or, you know, a celebrity, and show them the programs that worked. Because I think there's kind of sometimes people have a negative impact about countries in sub-Saharan Africa, or like not great places, but instead they really are. And there's a lot of programs for a small investment on the part of the U.S. that are really, really successful in changing people's lives. And so I traveled there, you know, on one trip with Cindy McCain and Connie Britton and Dana Perino. And so, you know, that really helped then to spread the message when we came back, because not only did we want to have like government officials care about this, but we wanted constituents of these members of Congress to care about it, and having different messengers be able to deliver that was very effective.
And did you also work on the debt forgiveness? Was that part of it too?
That was before I got there. That was sort of their very first thing that they did when they started. And the organization was called Data back then. And and then they kind of added the grassroots and overall movement piece and combined that, and it became one.
And everything I read, he was very involved and working on it.
Bono's really, he's very, very knowledgeable and spends a lot of time thinking about it and advocating. And so, you know, when we would go travel, I mean, when we'd go to visit, when he was in DC, members of Congress, it was very impressive. And he wasn't just someone who came in with like a big picture idea. Like, he knew the root of the problems. He knew potential solutions. He had, you know, relationships with leaders all over the world that he could bring together. So he's really, you know, one of the best.
So who is, you know, they say cool under pressure. Who is more calm under pressure, Obama or Bono?
I guess they both are, you know. I mean, I've seen Bono, like, you know, he's kind of amazing. He'll do like work with us on advocacy all day and then go do like an amazing concert that evening. So he has a ton of energy. But of course, President Obama, you know, has endless energy and has a very calm demeanor as well. So
extremely calm. Well, what was it like working on the Obama Biden campaign?
Yeah. So then I left one to become, like, I ran Joe Biden's part of the reelection campaign in 12. So back to Chicago again. So you can see the theme of Chicago, DC. And so that was great. We, you know, had very set roles. You know, it was like, where was the vice president most effective? Which group should he be talking to? What message should he focus on? And so that was my role in the campaign, is to kind of pull all of his stuff together. And we had a team of about 10 people that, you know, that worked on the vice president stuff. And that was great, because then I got to travel with him, you know, to, you know, a lot of places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Florida. And then, you know, combine that with what the overall campaign was doing on the reelection for President Obama was really great. And we did, you know, the debate with Paul Ryan was a highlight, and Vice President Biden did really well on that. And so, you know, that was a great experience. And for me, at that point, it had probably been 6 years since I had worked day to day on a campaign. And so I missed the campaign sometimes, you know, the day to day. So that was a good opportunity to go back and do a little bit of that.
Now, why do you say the debate was a high point? I mean, obviously, because he did well, or it was just kind of exciting to prepare
for
it?
And it kind of came on the heels of President Obama's first debate with Romney hadn't gone that well, and people were starting to get a little panicky. And so, you know, it was just like, okay, this is the time to deliver. And he did. And that was, you know, that was just in that environment, you know, being at the college where they had it was just great. And also, like, it went well. So yeah, I guess the combination of all those things.
Where did they have it?
It was in Kentucky. I'm trying to remember the name of the college. What, Central College, maybe? Something like that.
Okay, Kentucky. And then you were, so what did you do after that, after the campaign?
Yeah, so right after the campaign, I helped the Bidens with the inauguration, you know, kind of, that was just a quick temporary thing to kind of get that organized. And then I was Jill Biden, the vice president's wife, chief of staff. So I was her chief of staff for the last, for the second term in the White House. And that was, you know, again, great. She focused a lot on community colleges. She was a community college professor and she worked full time the whole time. And, but we also, at the same time, President Obama was focusing on those issues. And so we were able to be an integral part of that and, you know, set out some of that, you know, work with him on some of those policies. And then she also did a lot with military families. So she did a program called Joining Forces with Michelle Obama. And so that focused on not just members of the military, but also their families around employment, wellness, education for, you know, both like the GI Bill, but also like sibling, spouses and kids and kind of their educational needs. Because one of the things that's hard for kids that are part of military families is they move, like they have to move a lot. And then they might have missed the tryout for a sports team, or, you know, there's a strange requirement in one state that you have to take a certain history class, you know, and then they get there late in high school. And so we worked on a compact to make it, you know, all the states had to agree for military kids that, like, you couldn't do that. Like, you had to let them try out for a sport, and you had, you know, you couldn't put these requirements on them at the end, or that their AP classes transferred. So that was really interesting. And I learned a lot about kind of the challenges of a lot of military families and how they, you know, how they had to operate day to day. And it's not just the service member themselves. It's the entire family.
So needless to say, you are part of the Biden team. You must have a lot of former.
No question there.
You have a lot of former colleagues working on the campaign.
Yeah. So I've been able to do a fair amount to help him in addition to my day job on in Illinois. We had to do the process of like getting him on the ballot, and then in Illinois you also have to vote for delegates that go to the convention, but specifically to him. So we had to choose the delegates and then get them on the ballot. And then there was lots to do up until the primary. It was March, it was just a couple weeks ago, and it feels like forever ago now, but March 17th. And so I've been pretty busy, like in the evenings, and doing the Biden stuff in addition to my day to day.
Well, the you know, the change from South Carolina on has just been incredible.
Yeah, I mean, really
just amazing. Incredible.
Yeah, just really, incredible. Really amazing. I mean, I think the campaign always knew that South Carolina was going to be a good state for him, and that the earlier states, especially Iowa and New Hampshire, weren't really his base. But still, like, the huge momentum out of South Carolina was amazing. And then, and the performance on Super Tuesday was, you know, like, you know, at that point, the vice president didn't have a lot of resources to spend on TV or anything. And I think that's where you kind of see that people know him already and like him. And mm-hmm. So once they felt like they saw that he could win in South Carolina, a lot of people were like, that's just who I want, you know? And it's interesting because you can get caught up like reading Twitter and different things that, you know, don't really capture that kind of feeling of comfortableness that people have with him, kind of all over the spectrum on within the Democratic Party. So that's been great.
Well, and the margin of victory was just in South Carolina was
it was crazy, right? Yeah.
So let's jump to Tusk. How and why did you join Tusk Philanthropies?
Yeah. So after we ended in the White House, I came back to Chicago and I was just trying to think about what I wanted to do.
Did you spend eight years with the
four. Four. One year, well, five. Okay. 1 year on the 12 campaign and then the second term.
Right. Okay.
And then I was just touching base, you know, trying to think about what to do next. And Bradley and I had stayed in touch, and he had this idea about, you know, if we made it easier to vote, could we increase participation, especially in primaries, you know, in kind of low turnout elections. And right now, for example, most members of Congress, it's really the primary that's indicative of whether they'll win or not, because most districts are drawn to, you know, be one side or the other. There's very few competitive House races. But the turnout, so for example, like we always use Florida as an example, but if you're a congressman from Florida and there's been all the school shootings and the nightclub shootings, and like, you probably understand at some level that you should have an assault weapon ban. But in the primary, where you only have 15% turnout, and of that, of the 15%, you know, 12% of the 15 is NRA members. So they're the bulk of who's going to turn out and vote for you. And so you're not going to vote for that because, you know, but it's a very small number of people that dictate those policies. This, there's examples of like that on the Democratic side too. And so, you know, if you want to solve problems like healthcare or climate change, look at climate change. There's probably 60 to 70% of people in America that agree on some solution to climate change, but you can't get it done because the polarization on who's elected to Congress. So the big picture idea was like, can we get more people voting so we change the inputs into the political system and then hopefully get better outputs? And so I was very intrigued by that, and that sounded like a project worth working on. And so I started doing that in spring of 2017. And one of the things that, why I was talking about the military piece before, one of the things that, well, we, when Jill and I traveled, and especially in overseas, we found that a lot of military families had difficulties voting, and it just came up anecdotally. And so when we were thinking about this, one of the thoughts was like, what if we started with military and overseas voters? Because there's just a lot of good reasons that we should make it easier for them to vote. And if you're a deployed military member, you're not going to be able to scan something or print it out or fax it, you know? So we started looking at like what technologies existed, and also talking to election officials to see if anyone was interested. And Mac Warner from West Virginia was the first person who was really interested in this. He's Secretary of State there, but he had been in the military himself and has 4 kids in the military and had problems voting, and his kids had problem voting. So he was very, very committed to like military voting, more than mobile voting, just like making it easier for military members to vote. So we did the first pilot with him in 2018, just 2 counties for the primary to see if everything worked. And the people that used it really liked it, and so they decided to expand it for the general in 2018. And then in 2019, we did the city of Denver, their municipal election and their runoff, and a couple counties in Oregon, Utah County, 1 county in Washington. And so ended up mostly for military and overseas voters, testing different technologies, different vendors. And then in Utah County in the November election, allowed voters with disabilities to use it for the first time. And that was really amazing. We have a great like TV clip of a woman who's 106 years old, who's in her, you know, has to stay in her home and was able to vote on her iPad. And I was just like, she was so happy and she didn't have to go anywhere. And that's great. So this year we're starting back up again, and we're continuing some of the counties in Oregon and Utah. And then also West Virginia is now going to allow mobile voting for not only military and overseas, but also all voters with disabilities. And Delaware is doing something similar. So we've been able to do a lot of work and a lot of testing. Oh, and then you were mentioning Seattle. We did the King County, which is Seattle, King County Conservation District. So it was a pretty small, like, local election for their Board of Supervisors, but we were able to make mobile voting available for all the citizens that wanted to use it. And it's interesting because you had a choice, like you got the ballot on your phone or your device, you could mark it, and then you had a choice whether you wanted to print it and mail it back or just submit it electronically. About 98% of people just submitted it back electronically. So there's, you know, when you give people the choice, I think they prefer the easier way. And we were able to double turnout from the last election, and we had no problems. And we did an audit after the fact with the National Cybersecurity Center, and that all went well. So it's, I think now, you know, a really good time for election officials to think about trying this, especially if we're dealing with coronavirus as we go into the fall, or we're uncertain about it, at least having it as a backup plan would make a lot of sense. And then maybe for right. certain populations, you know, like right. people who are older or immunocompromised, because right. we don't, you know, mail is great as part of the solution too, but there's 2 issues that it doesn't deal with. One is if you have a certain disability, especially if you're blind, a paper ballot coming in the mail doesn't help you. So we've been working with the National Federation for the Blind and the Disability Rights Network to kind of make sure that members of Congress or legislators who are working on this know that. And then also just we don't 100% know what the coronavirus, like, envelopes okay, or, you know, that kind of thing. So for the most, you know, for people who also people who really wouldn't be able to, like, go out to a mailbox or a Dropbox, having something where they can just do it all with their own device from their home would seems to me to be the perfect time to try this.
So basically what it does is it does away with the extremes in the primaries, because you drive up turnout.
Yeah, turnout.
That way,
yeah.
It softens the extremes, as you were describing.
Right.
Now, one of the criticisms, and I'm not saying it's valid, but one of the things you hear is that you may get opposition from Republicans or conservatives with this type of mobile voting. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so far that hasn't been the case, because the states that have done it and the municipalities are about equally split. West Virginia, Secretary of State's Republican, the county clerk in Utah County is Republican. I guess Denver is nonpartisan, but you know, so it hasn't borne out that way. I think sometimes I think Republicans are more interested or maybe more open to new technologies just in general. Mm-hmm. And whereas I think some of the Democrats are, we were trying to get a pilot done in Alaska during the presidential primary, because a lot of Alaskan natives live off the grid, so they don't have access to the mail or no in-person voting place. And we tried to get that approved through the DNC for a couple months. And there was just a lot of concern about something new and hacking and, you know, so I don't know. It's, I think we have issues in both political parties, but they're different issues.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's accurate. I mean, I think you're going to drive up turnout, and you're going to, as you said, soften the extremes. But
yes, everyone might like have. That.
Yeah, I think you're going to have more of a populist message, and more of a populist. You know, I'm not. I don't think it's accurate, but it is something that has been said. So, can you tell our listeners what is it like using the mobile app? It seems for people like me, it seems like this is clearly going to be the way voting is going to happen in the future. And you guys, you have accomplished in 2 years is incredible. I mean, 2 years ago, you ran a pilot for two counties in Virginia. And look at where you are today, running the, you know, allowing everyone in the Seattle election to use it, doubling turnout.
Yeah.
So if you're doubling turnout, you're clearly going to reduce the extremes of both parties. And I think you're going to have a more moderate representatives.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's definitely the goal. And also the goal is to try to have some of this technology, like, people more comfortable with it and tested, so that when you have, like, someone who's 10 years old or 14 years old today, and they're going to vote in 4 or 8 years, you know, those kids are doing everything on their phone in a way that we didn't, you know, we all use our phones, but it's not as intrinsic to us. And I think that, you know, if you want to keep that turnout up and keep kids, you know, younger voters involved, you know, I think it's Jocelyn, who's the election director in Denver. She always says, you have to meet voters where they are. And we have to have this stuff ready, or we're going to lose a lot of people. So, but there's, you know, we definitely have, you know, we've had a lot of success, but then, you know, we had the Iowa app, which had nothing to do with voting, but, you know, makes people nervous. So there's, you know, it's you move two steps forward, one back, but I think we're making good progress. And now really is a good time for election officials to try it when we have the health concerns about in-person voting.
And so, like in Seattle, what would you do? You would download the app, and then the ballot would be there, and you would vote and send it in, or how does it work?
On that, you would get it on the ballot on your device, you would mark it, and then you would just submit it, and then it would go to the cloud, one of the DHS clouds that, you know, for federal government, and then
I'm 65 years old, living in Seattle. I have a smartphone, but I'm not that tech savvy. So how does it work? Do they get something in the mail and tell them how to do it, or how do they?
Yeah, you can do it. You know, that kind of depends on each jurisdiction, how they want to inform voters. If they send it automatically, you might just get a message saying, here, press this and download your ballot. Or
email them a link or something.
Email a link. That's what it was in Seattle last time, but a lot of how they do it in the beginning processes are really up to the jurisdiction and what process. Like West Virginia, has more of an ID requirement. So, and that pilot, like people scanned or took a photo of their ID and matched it against a live selfie. So there's all, you know, all different things.
Okay. And then what, right now looking, what other areas are you looking to try this in the fall?
Yeah, so we're hoping that there's some jurisdictions, or at least, like I mentioned, as part of a vote by mail process, that would allow mobile voting for part of the populations if the coronavirus is still in place. Otherwise, we're just looking to, I think this year we'll see a lot more use of this for voters with disabilities. And I think that'll be interesting because while military and overseas have been great, then you don't, like, other people in the community don't see it. You know, they don't hear about it as much because it's people who are living abroad. But if it's somebody in your community that's able to use their phone to vote, you know, I think sometimes just like hearing about it, seeing it helps other people become more comfortable. The other thing that's kind of interesting now, it's tangentially related, is members of Congress are now thinking about remote voting for themselves for their congressional votes. And I think that could be really interesting too, because then it would make them a lot more comfortable with technology and voting from a different location. And that would be pretty easy to set up because, you know, you're voting yes or no. So it's easy and it's not a secret vote. So, but I do think any kind of advances where people start to feel comfortable with using the technology that we have or can develop to do safe and secure voting from remote areas will just make everybody feel more comfortable in the long run.
And what kind of platform do you use to make sure that it's secure?
So there's a couple different vendors in the space, and we have a firm called Shift State that we've worked with. It's former FBI cybersecurity agents that have them do, like, that check the security for us and the technology, because Bradley and I are not technologists. But Shift State does that work for us, and then we do post-election audits as well. And we've been using a couple different vendors over the last two years. So I think we'll and we want to kind of keep working on that piece too. You know, it's like we want more jurisdictions to try it, but we want more vendors in the space as well. Because when you have that competition and you have people like, you know, then innovation gets spurred and we can even get to a better system or a better technology. And you have to really stay, you know, you have to really keep testing and retesting on the security side, because just because like everything was good last time doesn't necessarily mean it will next. So we feel, you know, committed to making sure that we stay on all the vendors and make sure that they stay up to speed. And then, you know, at some point, maybe there's a way that if none of the vendors have the exact right model that the states want, maybe there's an opportunity to partner with a university or something to create an open source type of system that could be made available to everyone. So there's lots of work ahead for sure, but lots of progress so far.
Well, it's it's incredibly generous of Bradley Tusk and you to be doing this work. You know, to remind our listeners, it is a nonprofit. This is not their business.
Just actually even make a point not to invest in any of the companies. You know, Bradley has an investment fund, but just we don't want to care. You know, like whichever one works, whichever one's the best. We're technology agnostic and vendor agnostic. We just want the best result.
Yeah. And it's really great. And so for any election officials listening or anyone, active in elections, you know, reach out to, Sheila, and, it's really, really exciting. And I'm a true believer, and I think it's what the future is going to be. And I think, maybe this year you're going to see a lot more people,
election officials
reaching out to you. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And for all our listeners, don't forget, you can follow us as you're sitting at home. You can follow us on Twitter. You can sign up for our Monday morning email at our website, the lobbyingshow.com. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And we wish you all the best and want everyone to stay safe. So until next Monday, have a great week.